This is the examination of the hidden human condition.
You're listening to the Hidden Killers podcast.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi.
We're talking with retired FBI special agent, director of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Robin Dreek is with us. Robin, welcome as always, and thank you. I want to talk about Brian Koberger here a little bit today. The defense team now been getting access to training records of three police officers involved in the investigation of the murders of the four Idaho students. Let's talk about that a little bit. These are records that have nothing to do with the actual crime itself, training taking place before the crime was even committed. What does this step mean for the case?
Yeah, the when I was reading that as well, the thing that just struck me was poking holes of doubt, you know, for a jury is was my first thing that popped into my mind. But then when I kind of looked at the fact of these three officers, what each of these officers' roles was during the investigation, once again, I was impressed. I've been very impressed with the Koberger law enforcement side throughout this entire thing. I know a lot of people jumped on, how come we don't know? How come what's going on? You know, for the first month or two, as we didn't think anything was much going on. And I really credit a lot of that towards the challenging communication they were putting out. Is a little disjointed. I don't think they really had a good comm plan in effect, you know, with the prosecutor coming out with stuff and then other people coming. I mean, it was just kind of all over the place. But I think once they dialed that in, we saw a pretty coherent message, especially after they arrested him. And what has always struck me with that department, mostly from the video that they showed from the body cam footage of the officers when they first went by that house during a house party to talk to the girls and the occupants there, you know, this is prior to the murder, about the noise violations and things like that. And it really, they were really good. They communicated well. You could tell that they had a good relationship with the campus, with the students on the campus. And when you have that kind of healthy relationship between a community that size and law enforcement in general, and then when I saw that these three officers, that each of these young, and I know that it was a young force, not a lot of experience in some of these people, but I really liked what I saw. I saw a lot of good, healthy reps, repetitions with the things they were doing. They seem young, they seem into it, they seem to have good relationships. Again, that comes from the top down. And so I don't think it's anything but the defense trying to poke holes of doubt if they're going for the death penalty.
When they look at the training records of these folks, I mean, is there anything? I mean, what would they be looking for to find to poke holes in someone's training as then it would actually pertain to their roles in this investigation?
I would guess, again, this is a guess on this. I'm guessing they're going to try to find areas that they weren't trained to do the parts of the investigation they were doing. And that's, it really depends on how the defense uses it and then how the prosecution counters it, because training is nothing more than learning how to do a process. It's, you know, law enforcement and life in general is an art form, and it takes years of repetition to get this art form down. I mean, hell, when we're born, we don't know how to speak. When we first start speaking, we can only say a word here and there. And then after years of repetition, some of us become really good orators and others are still okay, but it takes years of reps. And same thing with training. Training in law enforcement is meant to give you a baseline skills, tools, and techniques to learn what to practice at that rudimentary level so that after some experience, you get that next level of mastery from those repetitions. And so I think they're going to be just going for, did they receive the training in the areas of the investigation they were in charge of? That's what best thing I can guess at it.
When you have a defense that is going to these areas for the defense of their client, is that a sign that there really isn't a lot of ways to defend this individual other than trying to do the look over here, but what about this guy? And then get pieces thrown out or individuals. I know these people are not assigned to testify, but obviously their role in the investigation was what they were. Is it a desperate move at this point to be going down that road?
that would be my take on it, just like yours is. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, you and I sit here as our on our armchairs with conjecture. But
sure.
But yeah, I mean, it seems to be that way because, like they said, you know, they're not going to testify, but their evidence and the way they collected it mm-hmm. is going to be, you know, admissible. And I think that's what we're going to try to poke holes in. It's just when you're going for the death penalty, when you're going for these high stakes things, and we saw this in a Daybell trial too. You know, their only thing they could do because the evidence was so overwhelming is try to poke holes of seeds of doubt because mm-hmm. you have to have a unanimous jury to go and go for the big thing like they're going for the death penalty here. And if you poke a seed in the doubt of one person because of anything, that's what you're going to try to do. So I think that's what they're doing.
There's been some objections raised about demolishing the house on King Road where everyone was killed. Members of three of the victims' families saying it should be preserved until the trial has concluded, which, you know, it could be later this year. It could be many years from now. We don't really know for sure yet. It's certainly scheduled for October, but that could change. Is having a place like this, the evidence, the home itself, does it play that key of a role in a trial anymore to be saved?
I think so. I mean, we saw that in a couple of the cases that you and I have tracked mm-hmm. where especially the Alec Murdaugh case, you know, they brought the jurors out there and they walked the ground at the dog kennels and they could kind of see the distances. You can kind of see the environment in which the murder took place. I think emotionally it can make a strong connection when a prosecution is trying to say, here's what happened. As they're painting a picture for the jury, being able to actually walk the ground and kind of taste the energy that's in the air and feel that vibration. I know it sounds kind of woo-ish, but it's actually palpable. Yep. You know, when you go to these locations and these environments, and we saw it also with the case with, I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it's the one where the child predator was let out ahead of his parole that he shouldn't have been let out on. And then him and his wife wound up having a sleepover and the kids are all killed. And all the parents are walking through because the evidence was not collected well. And the parents are, I mean, it's just, but you could actually see, you know, where these things take place. And I think it makes a big impact on a jury when doing it. So I'm all in favor of preserving that so that if the prosecution decides to bring the jury through, they can kind of see how it would have happened, where it would have happened, the time and the distance, all those things go into it.
Does that play a role in, I guess, and I'm not trying to stick up for Koberger, but could moments like that have influence to falsely convict someone just because, you know, you get into the environment and you do feel those things. And if they're telling you this is the guy who we believe did it, wouldn't that almost, you know, in some way connect those emotions to that person? Whether or not you're believing they're guilty or not, could that sway people into guilt when maybe they shouldn't be at that point? But just because of the raw emotions of being in an environment like that, it certainly makes an impact.
Sure, absolutely. You're talking about confirmation bias. And if the prosecution does a good job of painting a negative confirmation bias against the client by those emotions, because that's what confirmation bias mm-hmm. is. It's our interpretation of the emotions surrounding an event or an individual. And then from that point forward, there's nothing that can sway us. It's mm-hmm. very challenging. So, because once we have that confirmation bias, we're continually looking for things to validate our own thoughts and opinions. Because, you know, Robert Greene's laws of human nature, you know, he states very clearly that we human beings, we consume information that validates our own opinions that we have of ourselves and the world around us. And so if they can emotionally tie negativity towards an individual or anything. That's why jurists are told, don't read the news, don't do anything. That's why the jury selection process is extremely thorough to see, is there any pre-existing negative confirmation bias regarding the case, regarding the subject, because it's extremely powerful and you're never going to get rid of it, mm-hmm. but you're going to do all you can to mitigate it.
This is the examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi.
Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. His website, peopleformula.com. Please do go and check that out. And if you like this podcast, press subscribe wherever you're downloading them so you don't miss any of our breaking updates, episodes, insight into the case. Even get an ad-free experience through Apple Podcasts right now. My name is Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.